Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. This is a Literary Studies podcast, and I'm Natalia, one of the hosts on the channel. Today I will be speaking with Maria Rybakovich, and we will be discussing her publication, Literature, Exile, Alterity, the New York Group of Ukrainian Poets. Hello, Maria.
Hello, Natalia. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. So before we discuss your publication, would you mind if you say just a few words about yourself?
I received my PhD in Slavic literatures and languages from the University of Toronto in 2001. And at present, I teach Ukrainian literature courses at Rutgers University, New Brunswick campus, but I'm still affiliated with the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Washington in Seattle, where I spent almost 7 years, and I also taught Ukrainian literature courses there. My current project, I have to say that I just finished my second book, which deals with contemporary Ukrainian literature and the from the angle of identity construction. And I titled this book tentatively as Ukraine's Quest for Identity, Two Decades of Cultural Hybridity in Literary Imagination, 1991-2007. So that's a little bit about me.
I would be very much interested in discussing your recent publication as well. So could you just tell us a little bit about that recent research? What writers did you include into this recent publication?
That's quite a big project, if I may that way. At some point, I had to limit myself, because to write about contemporary literature is difficult because you don't know where to stop, so to say. So I decided that I'm going to focus on the first two decades after independence, and I'm looking at how identity formation is reflected in Ukrainian literary text, and also to what extent these authors and texts influence identity formation in those 2 decades after independence. And I focus on the most important contemporary authors such as Yuri Andruhovich, Oksana Zabushko, and many other authors. But I think that, you know, like once the book is published, that would be another conversation, and I would be happy to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
But I'm excited that it's done, because it was also a project that was, I worked for it for like almost a decade. So like I'm really glad that finally I finish it.
Okay, but then your previous publication, Literature, Exile, and Alterity, would you say a few words about the background of this research? How did the project start and how did it evolve?
Yes, thank you for this question. My involvement with the New York Group is really personal, it's kind of hard to talk about the beginning of this project without giving a little bit of that background. I was working on my PhD at the University of Toronto back in the mid-1980s, and at the time I was also an aspiring Ukrainian poet in diaspora. So I wanted to have my poems published, and I contacted a literary editor of the journal Suchasnys, which is like, you know, the Contemporary Times, that was published here in New York and also in Munich. And that editor, literary editor, was Bogdan Bojchuk, who is a founding member of the New York Group of Poets. And our correspondence started, then we met and fell in love. And actually, I moved from Toronto to New York so we could be together. So I interrupted my PhD studies. But some decade later, in mid-1990s, I decided that I do want to finish my doctorate, and I returned to Toronto. But at the time, I decided that my focus should not be Slavic linguistics, which was what I was doing when I met Bohdan Vujčuk, but I wanted to switch to literature. Mm-hmm. And my advisor at that time, Professor Danilo Struk, suggested that I worked on the NEO group. He knew that I'm that I'm involved with the group, that I'm also like part of the group. Mm-hmm. And he said that it would be very interesting for him to supervise a thesis like that. So the beginning of the book is really connected to my dissertation, which I wrote and defended at the University of Toronto. But the book itself evolved beyond that. So it is, I would say, it is based maybe like 2/3 of the dissertation. And the last 3 chapters were actually written after I got my PhD. And of course, it's rearranged, reworked, and re-edited. So it's not exactly the same as my dissertation, but that's the beginning of the project, and that's how it all started. Mm-hmm.
So could you describe the new, your group of Ukrainian poets? What does the term itself communicate? Because you mentioned elsewhere that the poets who are considered members of this group lived in different American cities and towns, even in different countries, I would say. So what are they, why are they placed under the umbrella of New York group?
The group was never some kind of a formal organization. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty much a group of friends who all wanted to create and express themselves in Ukrainian language. So that was kind of element that connected them. I mentioned somewhere that New York City signified for those poets an innovative approach to poetry, to Ukrainian poetry. And it's true that they all wanted to experiment with poetic forms. They all embraced vers libre and metaphor, embraced modernism and such fashionable at the time, we're talking about the mid-1950s, trends as existentialism and surrealism. So New York City had this like symbolic importance for them because that was a very vibrant culturally and aesthetically city in following World War II. But it also was the place that actually most of the poets met and worked. So it has both like literal and symbolic meaning. But it's true that some poets resided in and still reside in different places, but at some point in their lives they actually came to New York. Mm-hmm. And got to know each other and kind of were active together. So the beginning of the group goes to the meeting between Bohdan Vujčuk and Yuri Tarnavsky. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that they also started to correspond with Bohdan Vujčuk, who lived in Chicago at that time. And shortly after that, Zhenya Vasilkivska joined the group, and she was in New York at that time. She was actually working on her PhD in French literature at Columbia University. Then Yuri Tarnavsky met an American woman, Patricia Nell Warren, who then shortly after learn Ukrainian and learn it so well that started to write poetry herself. So that was another addition to the group. And in 1957, Emma Andijewska came to New York from Munich and spent in New York maybe like close to 3 years, when then went back to Munich. And finally in 1959, Vera Vogt came from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil and also spent like half a year in New York, and that's how her association with the New York group began. So this is this 7 founding members of the New York group that my book focuses on, because in fact there are some other poets that join this grouping later on in the mid-60s. There were additional 2 poets from Chicago, Oleg Koverko and Yuri Kolomeitz. There was also a young poet Marko Carinnik, who lived in Philadelphia at the time and then later moved to Toronto. He still lives in Toronto. And also another poet, Roman Baboval, that always, and he already passed away, lived in Belgium. And finally, I was, you know, the last addition, so to say, to the group. But my book does not focus on those later poets, but just on the founding members, on the seven founding poets. So among those seven, most of them, well, maybe I shouldn't say most of them, but at least two of them, both Dan Buchuk and Yuri Tarnavsky, they were always associated with New York. And Emma Dievska moved to Munich, Vera Volk was in Rio de Janeiro, and Bogdan Rubchak, there was a short period from mid-1960s, a decade really, from mid-1960s to 1970s, that he lived on the East Coast. Actually, he was working on his PhD at Rutgers University, and then moved back to Chicago in the 1970s. So New York always was that place that, how should I put it, that invited them all, right, you know, to be in that place.
So is there any date which is considered to be like a foundation date for this group, or it's just goes under the umbrella, so to speak, of some decade?
There's no one date, but, you know, it all depends how you look at it. As I mentioned earlier, it really, the beginning of it goes back to the meeting between Buchuk and Tarnavsky, which happened in 1953. In 1954, if I'm not mistaken, they already started to write some, contribute poetry to the Studentske Slovo, there's like student word that was a supplement to the newspaper Svoboda. Then they also had literary evenings combined with artistic exhibitions with artists, and that happened in 1955. I also look at their poetic debuts, like both Tarnavsky and Rubchak. Their first books came out in 1956, Boychuk's in 1957. So that is also an important date. But at the time, they still, it was like pretty much an association of friends. Some could look at 1958 as like an official beginning, because that was the year that they assumed that name, the New York group, like as sort of their trademark, if I may put it that way. And it happened because at that time they already wanted to publish a poetry almanac or an annual, and they call it Novi Poezji, New Poetry. And they also wanted to have their own publishing house, and they needed some kind of a name for it. So they assumed this New York group. So that has a very concrete date. And Yuri Tarnavsky even mentions that in his diary, that he remembers that moment when they came up with that name, and it was in one of Greenwich Village cafes in New York where they were sitting. He, Tarnavsky, Patricia Kilina, Bogdan Buchuk, and Buchuk's first wife, Anya, and they came up with that name. So it's really kind of difficult to pinpoint what would be the actual beginning, but it's safe to say that the mid-1950s is where it all kind of started.
I see. So, and very often literary groups or literary schools produce some kind of manifesto. Did this group have any literary manifesto, or what was their main motto in terms of producing poetry? Because, like you mentioned, they were writing in the Ukrainian language, and it was probably some literary gesture and political gesture and social gesture as well.
Right. So that was one thing that they embraced, and they did it quite consciously, because they all came to the U.S. as children or young adults, and they could and went to schools, and they could very easily actually to switch and write in the English language. So the fact that they embrace it and made that very conscious decision that they will express themselves artistically in Ukrainian was a conscious choice. However, they never had any official manifesto. If you know, they didn't even consider themselves that they are some kind of a school, like a poetic school. That's why they prefer this more informal name as a group. But if we are talking, if certain what they wanted to stand for, I would say that their introduction to the first issue of Novi Poezii, New Poetry, could stand a little bit for that. And if you don't mind, I just want to read a little bit. It's a quotation that I translated myself, and because that is from Rubchak's letter to Tarnavsky, dated November 25th, 1955, because some literary critics that wrote about the new group were saying that, you know, their beginnings were very spontaneous, very kind of, that there was not much thought giving to it. Mm-hmm. But that letter would actually contradict that, because they were thinking about issues, and they were always thinking that, like, if they have a group that they could they could have more influence as a group than individually. So I'm going to read this excerpt from the letter. "We, the young Ukrainian writers, must keep together, must unite in indissoluble friendship, because individually we shall vanish without a trace. I hope you have realized the precariousness of our situation. 10, 15 more years of immigrant existence and no one would be writing in Ukrainian. Ukrainian culture undergoes an awful crisis nowadays, and it's truly faced with, forgive my cliché, the last to be or not to be. Please, Kulish and other wonderful people gave their lives for it. We do not dare put it down. Our task is to rescue it." So, you know, it's not the quotation that I wanted to find from Novi Poezii. Maybe I will later. But
it really sounds like a manifesto.
But it's kind of, you know, like, yes, that was private, right? They never wanted anything to put in public other than, again, this publication that they came up in 1959. But definitely among themselves, they were conscious that, you know, they could play an important role, considering that at the time Ukraine was really under the communist Soviet regime, and not much writers and artists could do. Like, there was no freedom of expression over there.
Mm-hmm. Were the members of the group collaborating with their colleagues in Ukraine, especially during the 60s and 70s, when it was quite troublesome to travel back and forth to the United States? And, well, you mentioned that in your research, that they were waiting for some invitation from the Ukrainian officials, but the Ukrainian officials were quite careful about inviting the poets from the States.
True. That collaboration came rather late, but it happened, one could almost say, like, by coincidence, because they certainly could not travel to Ukraine, although I will mention that later, one member of the group actually did, Vera Volk. But what happened is that two well-known poets, Ivan Drach and Dmytro Pavlichko, they came from Kiev to New York as part of the delegation to the United Nations, and that was a good opportunity for poets from Ukraine and from the New York group to get together and meet. So, and that happened in 1966. So pretty much a decade after the group began to be active. But that was a very important meeting indeed. And they try to somehow continue that collaboration, but it turned out that it's not so easy to do. And I'm sure that both Drudge and Pavlichko, their intentions were good. They actually wanted to invite the poets of the new group to Kiev so that they could have those official readings, and perhaps their poetry could be published, mm-hmm. if not individually, at least like maybe some kind of anthology. So these were the projects that they discussed. But in practice, what happened is like the poets of the group assumed they demanded an official invitation. They didn't just want to go there as tourists. And that official invitation never came. And it couldn't, actually. And I think that, I don't know if Drudge and Pavlichko still were so optimistic and in thinking that they could do such invitations, or they were maybe naive a little bit. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So the majority of poets did not travel to Ukraine until late in the, pretty much on the eve of the collapse of the mm-hmm. Soviet Union in 1989 and 1990. But there was an exception, and that exception was Vera Volk, mm-hmm. Who decided that it's not important for her, at least, to have that official invitation. She just went there as a tourist, and it was like the end of 60s. It happened like three times, mm-hmm. and it gave her an opportunity to interact with poets, and also with some younger group of poets that later were known as post-60-tniki, that mm-hmm. is this post-60s generation. Also among them were poets of the Kiev School of Poets. They're like four poets important from the late 60s and early 70s who did not really have a chance to kind of evolved officially. They were non-conformists and mm-hmm. obviously couldn't publish because they didn't want to follow the instructions, so to say, from the regime. So these contacts were important, and there was a big polemic between Vera Volk and Bogdan Boychuk on the pages of Suchasnis. There is this important emigre journal. Boychuk was of the opinion that she shouldn't collaborate, she shouldn't give that opportunity for officials, for the regime officials, to sponsor her readings and things like that. So the new, renewed, if I should put it that way, collaboration came late, mm-hmm. came actually at the end of the Soviet Union, 1989-1990, and that with publication of the new journal, Svitovit, in which I was also involved, and we managed to publish four issues in 1990, and then in 91 it was like a quarterly literary magazine, and those poets, Drudge and Pavlichko, were involved because they were part of the Union of Writers in Kyiv. So without their participation, it wouldn't be possible to have that kind of joint literary venture at that time. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much it, as we could say about those collaborations between poets. In fact, as I said, there was a little bit of contact in the second half of the 60s. Then it kind of died out and was renewed again at the end of the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you just one question about the poetry of the New York group. So your research places their poetry in an in-between space, and the poets represent hybrid writing, mentality, and consciousness, combining cultures and philosophies of their lost homeland, which was Ukraine and of the countries they moved to. And the poet's works demonstrate mixtures of various literary trends, and you talk about modernism and postmodernism trends in their writings. So the poets also seem to embrace both nostalgia because of their lost homeland and hope for finding a new home. So the New York group makes a gesture toward all-inclusiveness. At the same time, there is some sense of resistance, however, like political, cultural, historical, literary. What evokes that kind of resistance? What contributed to this kind of controversial, I would say, tone of the poetry of the New York group?
I would say that the poets of the New York group were not typical immigrant poets, mm-hmm. let's put it that way. I wouldn't say that there's a lot of nostalgia in their poetry, simply because, as I mentioned earlier, they left their homelands at the very young age, and it was mostly whatever walls in their minds, it was mostly like kind of imagined homeland than real one. But yet, because they decided to write in Ukrainian, mm-hmm. they kind of automatically excluded themselves from the mainstream, literary mainstream in the country, in the adopted countries. So indeed, there's a lot of paradoxical combinations there. At some point, I did mention that they toyed with postmodernist kind of devices, but really, at heart, they were all very modernist mm. poets. I would say maybe like late modernist poets. And what I mean by that is that they were consciously nurturing that link to modernism. That was very important for them, that to be part of that large, even we can say international family of, mm-hmm. of important literary figures that represented that trend. In terms of all inclusiveness, it really maybe it does seem that they try to embrace all those different and sometimes maybe conflicted tendencies, but I think that there were some principles that were important to them, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to compromise. So there was this rebellious spirit all along, and they didn't want to write perhaps in that traditional vein as their predecessor or even older contemporary to them, like poets that also happened to immigrate to North America. So there was that. They wanted to be new. They wanted to be different, and they wanted to be experimental, avant-garde. So mm-hmm. That's maybe one part, like in terms of this resistance, this avant-garde this aesthetic resistance. There's also like political principles that they try to follow, something that I already mentioned in terms of dealing with the center, dealing with Ukraine, that they didn't want to compromise, they didn't want to be seen as someone who cooperates with the regime. And resistance to even to the American literary kind of mainstream, I would say, because they were more European oriented. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that the time in the 1950s, when the Beat generation mm-hmm. was so active, they rather to look for such spiritual sources as East, like we know that Beat generation embraced this as Eastern spiritualism, right. the new group actually embraced existentialism. They were very, very much influenced by that philosophy. And they were atheists, with perhaps one exception of Vera Volk. They all actually were saying about themselves that they're atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I addressed your question here, but it's kind of like think about this resistance that you say. There's definitely something that they, they were outsiders. They were outsiders even in that emigre milieu, because while it has to be admitted that there were people who followed what they were doing and were buying their books, there were also people that look at them as not perhaps entirely Ukrainian, mm-hmm. whatever that would mean. So they were saying that those themes that they were taking up in their poetry and the way they wrote, that somehow did not look, you know, entirely Ukrainian. So definitely there were some clashes with mm-hmm. their own kind of emigre community, not only with the regime in then the Soviet Union.
Well, for the description of their poetry, you used the term referring to Andrew Gurr, exilic sensibility. And for Patricia Kalina, employed the term self-exile. So would you elaborate on those terms a little bit? Especially in terms of Patricia Kalina, her case is very interesting since she was born in the States and then she learned the Ukrainian language so quickly and then she started writing in Ukrainian. But then again, she went back to English.
Yes. Well, she's like a native. Well, I shouldn't say native because that's a different meaning. Like she's an American, you know, someone who was born in Montana in 1936, and one could say that it was just like a mere coincidence that she ended up within that Ukrainian emigre circle. And it happened because through her friend, she met Yuri Tarnavsky, another founding member of the group, and they got married. And that's how she joined the group. But going back to your question about the exilic sensibility and, well, exile in general, yes, I embrace this term because I thought that it really is a nice, it gives me a way to interpret their poetry. And even though, as I mentioned earlier, that they are not a typical emigre poets, and in the sense because they did not come to the United States as adults, but still either children or young adults, they developed their worldview and their aesthetics preferences already here. So that definitely removed, as I said, you know, this typical nostalgia in older poets. Was not as present in their poetry. Going back to exotic sensibility, I think that it manifests itself not only in feelings of alienation and otherness, but also in the desire to make their experience of exile, of displacement, as universal as possible. That could also connect them to modernism as such, because unlike postmodernism that focuses on particulars, on very local, modernism wants to have this experience, wants to put this in most general terms, like humanity mm-hmm. as a whole, perhaps. And it could also stem from their experience, even though they were very young, they did go through that World War II experience, which no doubt was very traumatic for most of them. And then that was the concern for the whole humanity, not just for Ukrainians. So exile, I look at exile as some kind of a displacement. Definitely you have to have some kind of a displacement. It could be geographical, but it could be also psychological. And it could also be linguistic. And mm-hmm. as I mentioned, this particular case of Patrycja Kilina, that the very fact that she decided to express herself poetically in a foreign language for her in Ukrainian, that's as if she kind of exiled herself into a different linguistic realm, right? That mm-hmm. that is also, in a way, exile. And her particular case could be not just linguistic, but the fact that she associated with the group that at that time, at least, was of a stateless nation, it's also kind of a certain displacement in a way. The feelings of alienation, the feelings of being other in that in the milieu of adopted homeland also contributed to that sense. They were not part of you know, they it is this feeling like in betweenness, this liminal feeling mm-hmm. that, you know, and on the one hand they're here, they're part of that culture and society, at the same time they are different. And it kind of also reminds me of what Edward Said was saying about those diasporic experiences as polyphonic, because you are mm-hmm. at the same time aware of more than one culture. You are very often aware of not just two, but even more than that. And that contributes to that sense of maybe embracing and maybe all inclusivity at the same time. Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the New York group positioned itself, or they positioned themselves outside any kind of center in terms of their lost homeland and in terms of their adopted homeland. So it was their conscious choice. On the other hand, it looks like the Ukrainian poets of that belong to this group, they embrace all kinds of literary traditions, European in particular. Where does the Ukrainian tradition stand in this sort of collaboration of everything, I would say? What's the influence of the Ukrainian literary tradition in terms of this exilic sensibility, for example, for the New York group? Because it does sound very European.
Yes, it's true. But if your question is what kind of, because like so far, and I emphasize those Western influences upon them, to what extent they were also influenced by their own kind of native Ukrainian poetic tradition. You could argue that they were, to some extent, maybe they didn't want to admit to themselves, but obviously, that excerpt from Rubchak's letter that I read indicates that they were well aware of what was already accomplished, especially in the 1920s. And there's a whole talented generation of Ukrainian writers, poets, and theater directors that pretty much perished because of Stalin's repression in the 1930s. So they were definitely aware of that. Interestingly, I have to say that, you know, as I said, they consider themselves modernists, definitely. But, you know, the way they look at their own Ukrainian tradition, literary tradition, they would say that, oh, they are the first real modernists in Ukrainian literature, which is not actually true. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we can look at modernism as something that evolves way from the end of the 19th century up to, you know, even 1970s. And they were just this very late phase of it, but definitely an important phase. So some would say that they were, you know, like they emphasized influences such as like Garcia Lorca, mm-hmm. Other Spanish poets such as Pablo, Spanish speaking poets like Pablo Neruda and Jimenez and many others. They did obviously were aware of the poetry of the 1920s, such as Pablo de Chena, mm-hmm. Bajan, many others, Blisko and many, many others. And that's something that I'm sure in some way they incorporated even subconsciously in their poetry.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I should have paraphrased my comment and say that they were fascinated with Western European influences rather than Eastern European influences. We were talking about all kinds of literary influences, you also have a chapter in your research that covers the Spanish influences on the New York group. What does this collaboration communicate about the aesthetics of the New York group?
I think that's one of the most unique and original contributions of the New York group, that something that I called like a Spanish turn, or even maybe a Spanish school in Ukrainian literature, because it was so pronounced. And it not only they were so eager to translate important Spanish language poets, and then publish them in their almanac New Poetry, but they also like incorporated themes, Spanish themes or Latin American themes into their poetry. In some cases, it was because like Vera Vogue, for example, like she resides in Brazil, so was very close to it. But in many cases, it was prompted, because they read a lot, those Spanish poets, but they also traveled a lot. And one poetry collection that Boychuk published, Pisni dla Mexico, like Songs for Mexico, were influenced by his trip to Mexico. Then we have Yuri Tarnowski and Patricia Kulina, who actually lived in Spain for a year and a half. They even bought an apartment in Santa there. And so they were fluent in Spanish. And that also found its way into their poetry. And in the case of Patricia Kulina, she has a whole poetry collection dedicated to Spanish cities. It's called like Pink Cities. Yuri Tanaski, on the other hand, has a prose poetry collection titled Bez Espanii, Without Spain, mm-hmm. which he wrote after they left Spain. It's very kind of interesting that it's so experimental and so opaque in many cases, that when you read it, it's not so much about Spain as it is about the lyrical hero. In name only, or really like incorporating certain themes in their poetry, that Spanish element is very, very strong. Now, what does it signify, right? Mm-hmm. Why that? Well, it could stem just from their interest. They obviously love reading that poetry, and in some way it influenced. But I also argued in the end that this turn to things Spanish, so to say, was maybe their guise of deeply felt and espoused internationalism, mm-hmm. maybe even cosmopolitanism. Although, arguably, and I actually mentioned that about Yuri Tarnowski, that perhaps this the case that he wanted to project himself as a cosmopolitan, maybe it was just a mask because he deeply cared about what is happening in Ukraine, and even has a few poems that could be very much interpreted as political poems against Russia, against her colonial oppression, if you will. So there could be many interpretations. For me, it kind of goes back to their fascination with modernism, and modernism as the most kind of international of all kind of artistic and aesthetic trends in the 20th century.
So the name of the group includes and focuses on an apparent geographical locus, which is New York. And I'm wondering how New York is represented in the poet's works.
Yes, and that's perhaps the most paradoxical situations of all, that considering how important New York City as a location for them was, how little actually they thematize that city in their poetry. It's not that it's not there, it is, and probably the most you could find references to it in Bohdan Bojchuk's poetry. He even mentioned certain streets. Not as directly in Yuri Tarnowski. He has in his early poetry many poems dedicated to cafes, and obviously these are New York cafes because that's where they were going and meeting and discussing things. But you would not find a direct reference to a particular cafe. So everything is more kind of general, and it's more about the lyrical hero rather than the context, so to say, rather than the surroundings. So the subjectivity of I, rather the subjective I, rather than the place, is more important. Why? I try to explain this more like from the kind of modernist angle, that this is how this focus on individual I on the one hand, and trying to present everything more like in universal terms, that it's a very modernist tendency. On the other hand, in some poets like Basil Machno, who immigrated to New York in 2000, when he writes about New York, he writes this with very, very great, with particularity. I mean, he embraces concrete places, he embraces concrete cafes, venues, names them. So that celebration of the concrete and local is very much the case of kind of postmodernist spirit, if you will. And something that is definitely not present in the poetry of the New York group. And mostly we're talking here about Yuri Tarnowski and Bohdan Bojchuk, two of the poets who actually are associated with this place the most, because as I mentioned, Bohdan Rubchak returned to Chicago and didn't really live that long in New York, and the same is true for Emma Dievska and Vera Volk, as well as for Patricia Kilina, who after she divorced Yuri Tarnavsky in 1973, she lived in New York for a few more years, but then she moved to California. So that could also be an explanation that these poets actually did not live here long enough to have that place somehow influence and find the way to poetry itself, so to say.
You mentioned somewhere that the group underwent a few stages of the development, and I would assume that probably their tone changed in some way after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And if so, did it really change? And if so, do you believe that their voices were heard by the center in both locations, in their lost homeland and in their adopted homeland?
Okay, so there are quite a few questions here. I'll try to do one by one. In terms of their development and activity, it's true that the longevity of the group is in a way amazing, because usually when a group or a school like exists, it doesn't take more than a decade and they somehow it dissipates. In the case of the New York group, it is amazing how long they managed to last, although obviously the quality of their activity as a group is not the same. So you could actually discern certain places in that development. And I would say that the most active and the most productive phase coincided with the publication of their annual, like New Poetry, which was published from 1959 until 1972, 73. The last issue was they had both dates, 72 and 73. Perhaps that the existence of that publication somehow mobilized them to cooperate and to be, productive, so to say. But like the 70s were that was the decades that somehow they all went their own directions. It's not that the group stopped to exist, but they were not as active, let's put that way. And even if they published something, that was mostly something that was written earlier. And the new kind of spirit came in the early 1980s when Bohdan Bochuk returned to work as a literary editor for the journal Sutrasny's Times. And that also almost coincided with the second half of the 1980s, where all those changes started to take place in the Soviet Union following Gorbachev's policies of glasnost and perestroika. And those contacts began to between diaspora and Ukraine were renewed and were, in a way, they were kind of mobilizing that something has to be done. And that idea of the new publication, of having a forum that would allow this dialogue, literary dialogue between diaspora and Ukraine, place to be. That was also something that motivated that activity. And as I mentioned already, Svitovit, this is how Svitovit was established and existed pretty much for a decade until 1999. And that was a forum that allowed not just for this dialogue to happen, but it also allow diaspora poets, the new group poets, to have a place to publish their poems and to publish mm-hmm. their work. And that was something that mobilized them. And my argument is that once the magazine Svitovit that is stopped its publication, that pretty much when the group voice died. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that, you know, individual members of the group stopped being active, although there were some that, you know, left the group quite early, and Zhenya Wasilkiewska was one of those that left the group even in the 1960s, and then in the 1970s, Patricia Kilina left. But the core of it, like Bojczuk group, Chuck Tarnowski, Andiewska, and Vera Vogue are still active even today, although, and has to be perhaps emphasized, especially Mandievska really denies its kind of involvement in the group and publicly says that she never actually belonged to the group, even though archival material would say something else, and there is a concrete there is even a letter in which she mentions mm-hmm. that she stops being a member of the group, and that there is a concrete reason why is that. But that's a kind of a digression, so to say. So in terms of this periphery and the center, well, periphery is it's logical, because like to write Ukrainian poetry in the United States, it's already peripheral, right? It's kind of removed from the geographical place where people actually, you know, read Ukrainian and speak and interact in Ukrainian. But I argued in the book that because when they started to be creatively active, that was the time that Ukrainian writers could not express themselves freely. So in a way, and we could argue that with the introduction of socialism, realism in the 1930s, the whole modernist development in Ukrainian pretty much stopped mm-hmm. and could not continue. And the importance of what was happening in diaspora obviously then grew even more. So they played a very important role in the sense that they had to continue the broken link between the early modernist phenomena and publications and later what was happening in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the post-war period. So aesthetically, at least, they are not as peripheral mm-hmm. as their geographical location would indicate. So that's my argument pretty much, that, you know, like if we look how they were situated geographically, so to say, yes, they were peripheral, but in terms of their contribution to the development of Ukrainian literature and Ukrainian modernism in particular, they were quite central and not peripheral. Although, you know, how they are appreciated mm-hmm. in Ukraine and to what extent they are known, it's another question, right? You know, that mm-hmm. was some after Ukraine became independent and they were going there often and publishing their books in Ukraine. And in the case of Bogdan Bojczuk, he actually lived, he mm-hmm. moved to Kiev. He lived like part-time there. They still, this status of being outsider pretty much continued. Although, you know, there are well-known and some of those poets, especially Mandievskaya, Yulia Tarnavsky, they are well even researched. There are, I don't even know exactly, but there are many dissertations being written on both of them. Bogdan Bujuk, on the other hand, was really active until his last days, publishing prose, publishing various articles. He was very active reviewing books, so he was pretty much in the center of what was happening until not so long ago. In terms of appreciation, I should mention another thing, because it's relatively recent. Young poet and film director Oleksandr Frazenko recently completed a documentary on the New York group. Mm-hmm. And it's really good that he managed to do it while still most of the members were alive. So,
mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned that you completed a recent publication as well, and it would be very interesting to talk about your recent research as well. But thank you so much for this fascinating research that contributes to the literary studies in the United States and in Ukraine. And thank you so much for this fascinating conversation today.
Thank you.